Good evening, everybody. It sure is good to see you. We have a family story. Do you guys got family stories? Stuff that's happened that you kind of mention from time to time? Well, we've got a family story. It has to do with my daughter, Lydia. When Lydia was in 7th and 8th grade, she was a better basketball player than you might anticipate. And she was on a team that was really, really good. In fact, I don't think they lost a girls' basketball game during junior high. And she was a big part of that. And I remember she was in 8th grade. They had a big, big game. And they were victorious. And everybody was so excited. And I went up to her after the game. I said, "Lydia, you did so well." And she looked at me and she goes, "Daddy, there is no I in win." And then she went, "Wait a minute, there is." We'll get back to that. We are in Corinth. We're on Paul's second missionary journey. Let me give you an idea. It starts in Jerusalem. We are going to head north. That's the Sea of Galilee, up to Damascus, one of the most dangerous parts of the world right now. See the Mediterranean? We're going to go up over Antioch, probably had the largest church in the world at that time. Now we're going to go to Tarsus, which is whose hometown? Paul's hometown. We're going to kick right on over to Asia Minor, Troas. This is where the Macedonian call happens. He goes across over into Greece. This is called Macedonia Philippi. From Philippi, he heads over, eventually ending up in Berea. From Berea, heads, probably sails down to Athens. From Athens, pops over to Corinth. Corinth is not the end of his second missionary journey. He stays there about a year and a half, heads to Ephesus, which later becomes a true base. From Ephesus, all the way back to Tyre. From Tyre, he's heading south, and with all trips, he ends up where he began, in Jerusalem. Paul arrived at Corinth in March of 50 AD. He meets Aquila and Priscilla, who have been expelled from Rome along with most of the other Jews by the Emperor Claudius. So you guys familiar with Claudius? Claudius is at least four fries short of a happy meal, okay? Claudius is very unstable in a lot of ways. He's brilliant in other ways, but he expels all of the Jews from Rome. Now, being fellows in the tent industry, Paul joined this Christian couple in their work, and there would have been plenty of work to do in Corinth. We know that every 2 years, Corinth hosted the Isthmian Games. And thousands poured into Corinth for these athletic contests that were second in popularity only to the Olympics, which cycled in the other 2 years. Since there was really no way the city could accommodate the crowds, people stayed in tent villages on the outskirts of town. Somebody had to make the tents. Somebody had to repair the tents. Now, I don't think Paul, I think Paul came from the tent-making industry in Tarsus, but he would have known how to make and repair a tent. And this is the kind of work that he's doing in Corinth immediately upon his visit there. Now, the Isthmian Games were held in honor of the god Poseidon. Remember the Poseidon Adventure, the old movie. The god Poseidon, it was open to all Greeks who competed for their providences, for individual honor, for the gods. And if they won, they got wreaths made of dried celery, 100% true. Events included chariot racing, boxing, an ancient version of ultimate fighting, but they also had more literate things. Music and poetry were part of the Isthmian Games, and of course, beach volleyball. Paul arrived about a year before the 51 AD games, and the city would have been preparing for the games. Now, based on Paul's propensity to use athletic metaphors in his writing and teaching, I think Paul's a sports fan. I do. I think Paul is a sports fan. I think he's a guy that watches the games. Now, in our text today, the apostle takes the Corinthian church to task. Around 57 AD, Paul is in Ephesus. Apollos, who's mentioned in this passage, reports that there's some real problems in the Corinthian church. Paul sends them a letter. They reject it. Paul then sends them a second letter, which is what we call 1 Corinthians. In this passage, Paul is not only defending his own apostolic authority, but he's mounting an offensive. Have you ever been in a point in your life you just got tired of being the target? You know what I'm talking about? And you decide you're just going to have to be the arrow for a little bit. That's really what Paul is doing right here. He's just sick of being the target, and he's going to become the arrow. Now, the Corinthian church thinks they are mature, sophisticated, urbane, spiritual, and healthy. And Paul insists they are immature, self-centered, worldly-minded, and they are big babies. Bottle-sucking babies. Verse 1. When I was with you, I couldn't talk to you as I would talk to mature Christians. How's that? When I was with you, I couldn't talk to you like I would an adult. You're adults, but I couldn't talk to you like you were. The tense of the Greek makes it clear here. The passage addresses the church as a whole. He's not just getting on individuals. You know, he's not just saying, you are out of line. No. He's on the church as a whole. He's also not addressing factions within the church. He thinks the whole church are big babies. Paul saw the church as one body, a team, entrusted by God with the mission of bringing Christ's salvation to the world. And at the end of the day, teams either win or lose. Can I hear an amen from somebody? And Corinth was losing. They just weren't getting the job done. One of my favorite baseball stories involved Pittsburgh Pirate great Ralph Kiner. After leading the National League in several offensive categories throughout the late 40s, he was informed in 1949 by his general manager, Branch Rickey, that he would get a 25% pay cut the next season. Kiner countered by citing all of his impressive statistics from the previous seasons, and they were impressive. To which Rickey flatly stated, "We finished last with you, we can finish last without you." And then he was given the ultimate baseball punishment and traded to the Cubs. The church is a team sport, not an individual sport. And teams either win together or they lose together. The problem with the Corinthian church is they were losing and they didn't even know it. They were losing and they didn't even know it. The literal translation here is, "I couldn't talk to you as spiritual people." For Paul, people are either infused with God's spirit or they are infused with the spirit of this world. The Corinthian church claimed Christ with their lips, but their hearts still very much belonged to this world. Verse 2, "I had to feed you milk, not solid food, and still you're not ready." Paul's kind of insulting, not kind of insulting them. Paul is insulting them here. You need to understand this. Paul often affectionately in his writings refers to those under his ministry as children, but he uses the word technon. That's the affectionate word that we use for children. If you see a cute child, that would be a technon, something that's endearing. But here Paul uses the word nepios, and it just means an infant. But when it's used in this way in the New Testament, it doesn't mean a cute baby. It points to immature behavior or arrested development. So what he's saying is, it would be like if I said to an adult, "You're acting like a big baby." It's not saying you're a cute baby when you're a baby. He's saying that they are acting like children. You know, there's something endearing about the relationship between a family and a child. We love our children. Children are always entering new stages, and helping them pass through those stages toward maturity is a shared role that is celebrated by families. And Paul's saying to the Corinthian church, "It's okay that I had to bottle feed you, but heaven's sakes, you guys have been in operation for 7 years. And by time you're 7 years old, you really ought to be off a bottle." Remember, that Paul's congregations are made up of Jews and Gentiles. They're made up of people of different races, cultures, and social economic statuses. Some of them, like the Jews, were really pretty well behaved in a moral Christian sense, but others in those congregations had just been straight up pagans. And frankly, after 7 years, they went to church, but they still weren't housebroken. They just weren't behaving themselves very well. For Paul, Christian immaturity is when your beliefs fail to result in the kind of actions that make the church and the individuals who comprise her more Christ-like. So for Paul, if you've been with Christ a while, you really ought to be getting more Christ-like. I'm going to use a metaphor here, since I already leaned into Ralph Kiner, and since I'm going to watch the World Series when I get home. But Paul's really saying, you know, there's nothing wrong with hitting the ball, with playing t-ball when you're a little bitty kid. But when you're 25 years old, you shouldn't be feeling real good about yourself because you're the best t-ball player. And that's really what he's saying to the Corinthian church. It's okay to be a baby when you are a baby, but when you're an adult, it's not okay to be a baby anymore. And you guys think you're adults, but you're still babies. What's Paul's evidence for their lack of maturity? Number one, a lack of holiness. Verse 3, for you are controlled by your own evil desires. Biblically, holiness means to be set apart for a special purpose. The church is holy because we've been set apart by God to bring salvation to the world. As I've told you a million times, the opposite of holy is not profane in the Bible. It's what? Ordinary. The worst thing a church can be is no different than any other club, organization, or charity. Because then we are what? Ordinary. We're just like everybody else. Paul is arguing that the church is thinking, valuing, and behaving no differently than the pagans who surround them. Way too many studies over the past decade have drawn the same conclusions about Christians today. For many Christians today, with the exception of occasionally attending church, our values, actions, and attitudes are really no different than those of our friends who don't know Christ. And Paul would contend that is a problem. Evidence number two, a lack of teamwork. You have become rivals of each other and quarrel with each other. Doesn't that prove you are not ready? Paul is saying, how can you claim to be mature Christians and spiritual people when sin, jealousy, and infighting are keeping you from your mission? You may believe the right stuff. You may be able to close your eyes and lift your hands when you sing. But your words, your attitudes, your actions, when you're not in church, betray you as nothing but spiritual infants. You see, in a church, we're never going to agree on everything. All of us are never going to agree on everything. And we don't have to. I don't mean this in a bad way, but I don't even agree with myself on some things. You got a couple issues out there that you just kind of waffle on, and you kind of see both sides, and, you know, how do you feel about that? Well, it's according to which day you catch me, is how I feel about that. But we must hold our mission of connecting people to Jesus above all else. And we must make sure that mission is never compromised by internal conflict or factions. We may disagree on some things, and we will disagree on some things, but we can't let it turn into drama, rivalry, and quarreling. Why? Because we are on the same team. We are on the same team. Evidence of spiritual immaturity number three, identities other than Christ. Paul now, it's going to get right at this. Verse 4, it's wrong to identify yourselves by your allegiance to human leaders rather than Christ. Now Paul addresses a primary source of the quarrels and divisions within the church. It's an unhealthy elevation of Christian human leaders. This verse has to be held up to chapter 2, verse 2, where Paul said, "For I have decided," now he's talking about his preaching, "for I have decided to concentrate only on Jesus and his death on the cross." For Paul, the sole building material in which you can construct a church is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There is no other foundation upon which you can build a church. So I need you to hear this. You can't build the church on your politics. You can't build the church on your world view. The only thing we can build the church on is Jesus Christ. There's nothing wrong with having favorite Christian writers or preachers or singers. But if our identity is found in them and not in Christ, there is something wrong with us. Because we are spiritual infants. And we're really too old to be that. A long time ago, I would have told you I was a St. Louis Rams fan. Did you ever notice the Rams got really good once they left St. Louis? It smacks of conspiracy, doesn't it? But I would have told you I was a St. Louis Rams fan. In those years, the Rams were the greatest show on turf. I watched all of the games. I may or may not have even kept up with games during church services. I thoroughly enjoyed the ride. However, as they began to break that team up, I discovered something. When they traded Kurt Warner to your New York Giants, my friend, I discovered I wasn't a Rams fan at all. Guess what I was? I was a Kurt Warner fan. And I started watching the Giants. And not the Rams. And when he got traded from the Giants to the Cardinals, I started watching the Cardinals and not the Giants. My allegiance was to an individual player. But it was not to the team. This may not be a problem in sport, but it's a disaster for the church. If your allegiance is to a person and not the church, it is a recipe for disaster. Making Christian leaders into celebrities harms everyone, and especially harms the cause of Christ. And that's what Paul is saying here. Don't elevate me. Don't elevate Apollos. We don't want to be who you center your identity around. We simply want to point to Jesus. A few years ago, I wrote this on my blog at my reverendshane.com. I've got at reverendshane.com, I have a blog or a website where I host what I write. I wrote this, and I'd like to read it to you tonight. This week, I read about the crash and burn of another well-known megachurch leader. It's truly heartbreaking. We've all watched this movie before. We cry every time. I hurt for the spouse and the family of the pastor, the congregation, and the many people who are just a little further from Jesus than they were before the announcement. I also hurt for the pastor. I don't know a single person who accepted the call to ministry hoping the whole thing would blow up and cause harm to the kingdom of God. Satan laughs. People of faith weep again. It's tragic by any account. As I was reflecting on the situation, Matthew's account of the temptation of Jesus came to mind. A clear theme of the wilderness showdown between Jesus and Satan was the lure of celebrity culture. Satan attempted to entice Jesus to throw off the larger mission, for a moment to jump off of the temple so everyone could see the angels rescue him. It was a straight-up publicity stunt. Satan effectively said, just film the whole thing on your iPhone, post it on YouTube, it will go viral, and you will be a star. And Jesus responded, do not test the Lord your God. Jesus passed the temptation of celebrity, but countless others who followed him would fail. The convergence of celebrity culture, worldwide social media, and massive congregations have certainly conspired to tempt and eventually ensnare some of the most gifted and talented pastors in the country. A part of Satan's temptation was to take Jesus' eyes off of the mission, to detract him from the purpose of his earthly manifestation toward the marketing and leverage of it. Jumping off the temple and the following angel rescue clip would no doubt sell books and gain Facebook friends and Twitter followers. It might even spark a new reality television show. The Jesus brand would benefit immensely, but the cost would come at the expense of the Jesus mission to seek and to save the lost. High-profile Christian leaders today are in a precarious position in many ways. On one hand, they have the opportunity to reach more people for Christ than was imaginable a generation ago. And on the other hand, there's never been more opportunities to lose your way, your principles, your morality, or your soul. And if they fall, they will take down many with them who deserve far better. It's easy to get lost in celebrity culture. Leaders must remember as a spiritual discipline that we are called to be servants and not celebrities. In a culture that worships at the cult of personality, Christian leaders who have been entrusted by God with the spotlight must remember that celebrity is precisely what Jesus rejected. Jesus said, "What should it profit a man if he gain the whole world but lose his soul?" It remains an excellent question. Keep it real. That's the word Paul's given to his church. The leadership you have are gifts to you. And if God has given you good leaders, thank God for that, but do not make celebrities out of them. Remember the story of Paul came up to this group of people and they thought he was a god? They thought he was a Greek god. You know, a lot of people today, I always joke about my first church. It's called the Kalibut Springs United Methodist Church. I got to tell you, man, I got the best start there. They were looking for a Messiah, and I thought I was one. You've never seen a church and a pastor hit it off so well, so quickly. You know, a lot of times people walk up to us, and they want to do to us what they did to Paul, and they want to say, "Hey, you must be a god." And a lot of people go, "Well, you know, maybe not really." But you know what Paul did? He said he just ripped his cloak. He said, "No, no, no, you will not destroy me like that, and I will not destroy you like that. I am not a god. I'm not a celebrity. I am a servant." When we start getting a hold of that, now we start to get a feel for Christian maturity. So now Paul is going to tell us what Christian maturity looks like. Number one, appreciate giftedness, but give glory to God. Verses 5 through 7, leaders are only servants of God who help people believe and do the work God gives them. My job was to plant, Apollo's job was to water, but only God can make the plant grow. The ones who do the planting and watering are not important. I love that. I'm going to say it again. The ones who do the planting and watering are not important. Only God who makes the plants grow is important. Theologian Gordon Fee, who I really like, wrote, "Paul and Apollos do have essential tasks to perform, but they have no independent importance." I love that. They do have a job to do, but they have no importance apart from doing that job. I feel the same about myself. I have an essential task to perform here as the senior pastor of this incredible church, but I have no independent importance. I'm just a ping hearer and a ping heater, like you. I'm just doing what God calls me to do in the same way I hope God is calling you to do what God's, or that you're doing what God's calling you to do. Christianity is a team sport. And anytime we get thinking the role of one person is of value apart from the greater whole, we begin to live our lives in spiritual immaturity. We begin to live our lives out of proper context. Now, I get it. I'm like a quarterback on a football team. I get more credit than I deserve when things go well, and I get more blame than I deserve when things don't. But at the end of the day, it is not about me. It's about each of us allowing God to use us as a team in the micro context of Christ Church, which fits in the macro context of the Church of Jesus Christ. We all are a part of that team. Evidence number two, clarity of roles. 8, the planter and the one who waters work together as a team to do God's work. Corinthian society was fiercely competitive. Like modern politicians, does anybody know an election's coming up? Corinthian society was fiercely competitive. Like modern politicians, leading Greek philosophers were constantly attempting to influence the public to reject the views and personalities of their rivals and to adopt their own views and their own personalities. Like social media today, their sense of importance was based on the size of their following. It appears that same mindset had invaded the church. And people gravitated around Christian leaders inside as they had once gravitated around politicians and philosophers outside. Paul reminds the church that though Christian leaders clearly have different skill sets and different sized followings and different callings, their value is measured by their contribution to the team, not individual performance. I'm just going to put it in a really blunt way. Doesn't matter if you went 4 for 4 and hit 4 home runs if your team loses. So know your role, do your job, and stay in your lane. I'm going to say it again. Know your role, do your job, and stay in your lane. You know what my role here is? I know a lot of people look at the church and they just assume I'm a benevolent dictator. And that is absolutely insane. My role here is to lead us toward our mission of connecting people with Jesus Christ and to make sure we stay focused there. It's to preach and teach the word, which is the part of my role I like the best. I'm just going to be very frank with you. That's the part I like the best. And I also need to raise the resources for the church. That's a part of my role here. But I don't do hardly anything else. You need to understand, though I help raise the resources for the church, I make no decisions on how money's spent here, none. Though I preach and teach, there are dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of other people who lead classes and connect groups and pour into our children and our students who are preachers and teachers in the same sense I am. I may be that in a macro sense here, but in a micro sense, there are probably hundreds of people in this church who have been gifted to do what they do. And what Paul is saying, when the church and the people in the church all understand what their gifts are, and when they know their roles, and when they do their job and stay in their lane, everything goes really well. You ever notice in football, it gets inconvenient if one of the guards decides he really wants to catch a lot of passes? Not only would he not be doing his job, and the quarterback would be sacked so soon the quarterback wouldn't have a chance to throw, if the quarterback does throw to the guard on a normal play, they throw a flag because he's an ineligible receiver. You know what guards need to do? What guards do. They need to block, and they don't need to block who they want. They need to block who they're told. And when they run their role, everything goes great. When I played football in high school, I was a wide receiver, but we didn't really throw to the wide receiver very much because I think deep in Coach Carnes' heart, he thought we'd have a better chance if it was 10 on 10. So I was kind of out there a long way, And I would do some things, but every now and then I'd have a job. And I remember one particular play. I was out, split out on this side. The play was a sweep my way. My job was to block the very first person I saw coming at the running back. And so the running back was running this way. I'm cutting back. I'm doubling back. And I see somebody, and I have no idea what I was thinking, but I thought, I'll hit the next guy. And I did. I let the first guy go. I hit the next guy. And the first guy absolutely obliterated our running back. I think we lost 10 yards and he fumbled. Whose fault was that? Me? You want to know why? Because I didn't know my role, I didn't do my job, and I didn't stay in my lane. When we do those things, God's offense runs. And when we don't, we get 10-yard losses and fumble. Evidence number three, coordination of gifts. Verse 9, we work together as partners with God, for you are God's, not ours. And by God's, I mean you are God's possessions, not our possessions. The church belongs to God. And what happens or doesn't happen in a church occurs because God's people either work, sacrifice, and evangelize as a coordinated team, or they don't. God has promised us in Scripture that God equips the church for the work of the church. So here's what I need you to understand. Everything we need is already here. All the finances we need to run the church is already here. All the leadership we need to run the church is already here. The volunteers we need for student, children's ministry, they're already here. Everything we need is already here. The question is, will people use those gifts for God? Will you and will I understand where our gifts are? Will we lean into our role? Will we do our job? Will we stay in our lane? We have everything we need, but will we coordinate those things? Football was always such an interesting sport to me. I never really understood it when I played. I remember the day I figured out our defense. I did. I was in bed one night. I couldn't sleep. Is anybody else's mind really sharp when you can't sleep? I have great epiphanies when I can't sleep. So I'm sitting there in bed, I can't sleep, and all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I completely understood our high school defensive structure. I completely understood the whole scheme. It came like that. Unfortunately, I was 2 years out of high school, but it did come. It did come. When I was playing, I never quite got it. I never quite understood that as a safety, that if I could tell they were running, I needed to not guard my receiver anymore. I needed to run up and that somebody would rotate around and guard my receiver. But because I was so linear in my thinking, because I thought that guarding that receiver was all about me, and because I didn't understand the greater scheme, I really hurt our team a lot of times. And I covered receivers very, very closely who were never going to get the ball on that play in a million years. And a lot of running backs gained way too many yards because the guy rotating behind me had to make the tackle because I was guarding a receiver who was never involved in the play. We got to know our roles. We got to know how the church works. We got to know our place in it. And we have to coordinate our gifts. Have you guys ever played like league volleyball, but not with great volleyball players, just like with regular people playing volleyball, but somewhat organized? Would you raise your hands? It's really terrible, isn't it? It's a terrible thing. One of the worst experiences of my life happened in community college. Our baseball team, during the winter, we had a class. I'm not exactly sure what we were supposed to do, but we had a class. It was a PE class for the baseball team. And I thought it was going to be great because I thought we were going to, like, you know, rest is what I thought we would do during this class. And I had some real skills there, incidentally. So I thought we were just going to like hang out and talk and have fun during that particular class. Well, come to find out, they got us all so we could spar the women's volleyball team. Well, they were all bigger than us. They were better athletes than us. And they actually knew how to play volleyball. So it was sort of like every day we were destroyed in volleyball by the women's volleyball team. If you want a metaphor, it was like Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn with a volleyball. Okay, that's kind of what happened there. But we were destroyed every single day. And we just were dominated by these players that were so much better than us. But you know what? After a while, about halfway through, we decided to organize. And we decided, wouldn't it be helpful maybe if we learned to play volleyball? And so guess what we started doing? We started staying in our actual positions. Because we were all playing volleyball like six-year-olds play soccer. We were all just chasing the ball and everybody hoping to kick it. And so we started playing our positions. And you know what? We never got to where we could beat them, but we got to where we could at least give them a decent contest. We were at least good enough to help them out a little bit before they played other teams, but we got a whole lot better. Well, have you ever played volleyball with non-real volleyball players and you had a volleyball hog on your team? That person that decides no one else can possibly play, so they've decided to play every position on the volleyball court. So they knock people down, they run, and they're just bulls in china shops. And let's just be real honest, we hate those people. Let's just be real honest, those people are incredibly annoying, and some of you are those people. And I'm sorry you had to hear it now. I'm sorry that you have to know how others felt about you when you were doing this. But no one was thinking, man, are they good? People were thinking, man, I wish they weren't on my team. That's what they're thinking. So I remember playing volleyball. And I remember we had this guy on our team who just decided, this was when we were playing like a league volleyball. We had this guy on our team who decided that most of our players were terrible. Let me be real clear. He was right. Most of our players were terrible. But he decided that he would just jump in front of all the other players. And he would always jump in front. He'd knock them down. I mean, it was just incredible. And we didn't do well. He's all over the place. It was an absolute mess. And finally, I just had to get him off the side. And I said, dude, here's the deal. Stop it. Just stop it. Because one guy can't play every position. And at some point, this game's going to be over and none of us are ever going to talk to you again. Just stop it. What Paul is saying to the Corinthian church is stop it. Stop it. Leaders, stop trying to play every single position. Just do what God called you to do. Keep your eyes on the goal. Play in such a way as your team wins, not to pad your own statistics so you'll make the all-star team. And players on the team, find out how you can help the team. You know what? If you're playing volleyball and you're up against the net and you're not really tall and can't jump really high, when I was young, I was both tall and I could jump. Now I'm roughly the same size. I do not have the vertical leap that could clear a Marissa phone book, okay? I got nothing. I mean, nothing. I jump and I don't leave the ground. Lots of things bounce, but nothing leaves the ground, you know? And so it's terrible. But no, figure out a way to help. I remember in softball when I got a little older and I thought, you know what? I used to could make those plays. I used to could get those balls, but how could I still help the team? I can help by being a good leader. I can help by being smart. I can help by teaching some of the younger players what I know. And as I aged in volleyball, in softball, I wasn't as good as I used to be, but I was very concerned every night to find a way to help the team. And some nights I was so bad, I just had to be a good teammate. I did. I just thought, I'm going to be a good teammate. I remember one night a guy hit a home run. I was like 0-for-4. Nothing good was happening. I made two errors that night. He hit a home run, kind of flipped the bat. I just went out and got the bat like a bat boy. I thought, I'm going to help this team somehow tonight. If nothing else, let's go pick a bat up. Guys, we got to be humble enough to say, I will do whatever it takes to help the team. One of my most profound moments here happened about 10 years ago, probably 11 or 12 years ago, because this was the sanctuary, and we had a very, very, very high-ranking military officer who was attending our church, the highest-ranking officer we'd ever had here. And I came into the sanctuary one day, and there was this person of just such incredibly high rank, so well-respected. You know what he was doing? He was sharpening pencils. You want to know why? Because the pencils needed sharpened. And he just wanted to be a servant. And I was so humbled. Let's just realize we're just servants. Let's just find a way to help the team. Because one person can't play every position. One person can't do everything. And the second you ask them to do that, you whack everything out. God has called us to work as a disciplined and coordinated team in pursuit of the mission God has set before us. And in order for that to happen, we must offer ourselves and our gifts fully to God without an ego and in all humility. We need to learn to heed God's pings. And we just need to say, hey, I realize it's safer on the sidelines, but I'm willing to enter the game. I may not have a lot to offer. I may have a lot to offer, but I'm willing to get in it. You see, a lot of Christians today are sort of like Midwestern high school sophomores at a school dance. I remember when I was a sophomore, we would go to school dances, and we were just like a gaggle of nerds standing on the side, and all we could really think of to do was make fun of the people who were actually dancing. You know, when I got a little older, I thought, you know what, at least they're out there. It's pretty easy to stay on the sidelines and make fun of the people who are dancing. It's something else entirely to put yourself out there and decide you're going to participate in what's going on. I just want to encourage you to put yourself out there and to participate in what's going on in the church. I know it's pretty easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize. I get that. Criticizing people is America's main sport. I get that. I get it. But let me tell you something. Critics don't help anybody. They just make themselves feel better about the fact they're doing nothing. And you know what? I'd rather be out there doing something and fail than be the most successful Monday morning quarterback in the history of the world. So I just want to encourage you to lean in to it. And those of you that are in it, that are trying to play everybody's position, cut it out. Just do what you do. Know your role. Do your job. Stay in your lane. Because when you stay in your lane, you make it possible for those around you to flourish in their own ministries. You make it possible for those around you to grow into the Christians God's created them to be. You know, one thing I said to the guy at the volleyball thing, it was playing everybody's position. It was early in this league, and I said, if you keep doing this, nobody will ever get any better. The people that don't know how to play will never get any better because they're never going to hit a ball. When we stay in our role, and when we coordinate our gifts with others, everybody else around us gets better. You know, for me as a sports fan, and for Paul as a sports fan, what makes a player good is that they have great individual talent, but what makes a player great is they lift everyone else up around them and they become champions. I was asked a while back who I thought the greatest basketball player of all time was. I said, Bill Russell. And they just looked at me and they said, why in the world did you say Bill Russell? I said, because he won 10 championships and he made everybody around him better. And at the end of the day, you either win or you don't. I don't want to be the leading scorer in the NBA on a team that's in last place. I'd rather be somebody who scores 3 points a game and dishes out 12 assists and gets 12 rebounds and helps make everybody around me better. And when I know my role and when I stay in my lane, and when you know your role, then the church becomes something incredible. Effective ministry is hard in the best of circumstances, but it's impossible in the worst of circumstances. So here's the big finish. Read it with me. An effective church needs mature Christians whose identities are based on Christ alone and use our gifts in coordination with the gifts of one another. That's it. And you say, well, Pastor, I thought it'd be more flashy. There you go. But that's it. We get this down, we got it. We don't get this down, we got nothing. Would you pray with me? Great and mighty God, thank you for this incredible teaching of Paul. Forgive us, dear God, if we don't think our gifts matter. Forgive us if we think we're all that in a bag of communion wafers and we just want to smother out the gifts of everybody else because we want the spotlight on us. Help us to see at the end of the day, you measure success in only one way. Have we honored you with the gifts you've given us? Have we used them in coordination with others? And has your church been made more effective by our life and by our ministry? Dear God, speak to us. Help us to see that we truly have something to offer. And I pray that as we freely offer those gifts, with identities based solely on Christ, and when we use them in coordination with the gifts of one another, that you look at us and you say, now there's a church I can use for my glory. In Jesus' name, amen. And I pray when Christ looks at Christ's church, he'll say, now there's a church I can use for my glory, because nothing's better than that.